This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I introduced myself, so I'll start with that. I am Koshu. Name outside of the temple is Jesse. I am here as Shuso for the winter practice period from January until April. And heart just settles right down every time I come here. I think it's a place that calls to a lot of people because people keep showing up. For those of you who don't know, it was founded by a teacher from Japan named Kobun Shino Roshi, who was a teacher of mine in the 90s. And we're here keeping his dream alive. And it is such an honor. And he was here keeping the dream of his teachers alive, and his teachers were there keeping the dream of their teachers alive. So I wanted to talk today about everybody's favorite topic, which is suffering. Something that we talk a lot about in Buddhism. It was the Buddha's first teaching after he perceived reality as it truly is, completely under the Bodhi tree. The first thing he said is, "We suffer." I once had a teacher say that it seems like such a downer that we're always talking about suffering. But then he would jokingly say, "Have you heard the good news? There's suffering." And that probably sounds a little odd to some of us. To some of us, it probably doesn't. And when we sit down on the cushion to meditate, we can have a tendency to try to sweep our suffering out of the way. We try and push it out of the way. We try and make space so that we can be calm. The truth of that is that it does have a tendency to come back and bite us if we try and push it out of the way, just like in life, you know. If we try to ignore our suffering, it finds a way to be present. When I was young and actually practicing with Kobun, our teacher in Colorado. He was the World Wisdom Chair at Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado, which is where I met him. And one of the first sessions I ever sat with him, I was in a lot of pain. My back hurt so much. So much that I was just forcing myself not to run out of the Zendo screaming. That was the best I could do in my practice. I'm glad I stayed. But it hurt. You know, I think I do want to mention that, you know, I had talked about sort of wanting to sweep suffering out of the way when we meditate. And I do want to mention that there is a place for letting go of thoughts, feelings, when we're on the cushion. If it's possible to let them go, then by all means, let's let them go. But sometimes it's not, right? Sometimes we're sitting with something and we breathe, and with the greatest of intentions, we say, I let it go, and it doesn't go. That sesshin that I sat back in Boulder when I was young. This is for people of my generation, my culture. There was a song that goes, "You can ring my bell, ring my bell." I had that song on my mind the entire sesshin because I was just waiting for someone to ring the bell. That was pretty much the only thing that happened on that sesshin was that song and me being in pain. I was thinking about another retreat that I sat only just a couple of years ago. At the time I was working as the executive director of a retreat center called the Rocky Mountain Eco Dharma Retreat Center in Colorado. And it was another time of suffering. I was the first executive director to come in after the founder of the center. And he was micromanaging me on a level that was very claustrophobic. And I was really struggling with my own confidence because I was being told that I was doing it wrong all the time. And so I was really struggling, really, you know, in a place of suffering. And there was one point when the board of directors for this organization had put together a committee called the Executive Committee, and their job was to police me, to make sure. And they were tracking my hours, they were tracking in detail everything that I was doing in my job to make sure that I wasn't going to destroy the center. And I was afraid of it too at that point, right? Because I was being told all of this. And there was a Zoom meeting with this committee. And I forgot it. I was driving up to the center to handle something that needed to be handled, and I missed the meeting. And at that point, it was like there was a big explosion. And I sat a sesshin shortly after that. I had a different experience from that early sesshin. I wasn't trying to run away. And I think the difference was that somewhere in the interim between being a young practitioner and being an older practitioner is that I learned to turn toward the suffering and not away from it. When I talk about suffering, you know, what the Buddha called dukkha, in our modern world, we have a tendency to conflate it with emotions, with physical states. Like if you're feeling anger or grief or sadness or pain, we call that suffering. And in Buddhism, I think we would actually not call that suffering. Those are just experiences. But if you can imagine, it's like we have a magnet in our chest. And we orient towards one thing, and the magnet pulls it toward it. We orient towards another thing, and it pushes us away. You know, this is sort of the heart of the poisons in Buddhism. Attraction and aversion. We want something. We grasp at it. Something outside of ourselves. Or we don't want something, we push it away. Like pain, physical pain. That's one that, you know, it's a really good opportunity to witness that. And when we sit on the cushion and we have something particularly that we don't want to be there, you know, maybe it's the pain that I felt when I was young, or maybe it's the despair, the lack of self-confidence that I felt in that job when I was older. But when we sit on the cushion, we have an opportunity to meet it. We always have an opportunity to meet it, but what we tend to do is we tend to turn away. Oh, I just realized that I didn't record. I'll start now. There's this whole other element of technology. Oh, maybe it is recording. Okay. Thank God somebody else is taking care of that. Ah. Where was I? We have this tendency in our lives to turn away from our suffering. And it's a natural thing to do. It's why we distract ourselves, you know. Plenty of that going on in the world these days. I distract myself. But there's this other option, which is to become intimate with it, to meet it. And even savor it. I know that sounds strange, but like maybe somebody who's an expert in tasting wine, you know, they're doing this thing where they, you know, they, I don't know why, but they're for some reason they're sloshing it around and then they're smelling it and they're, you know, like all the things that they do, right? They're doing everything that they can to experience all of the qualities of it. And it's possible to do that with our suffering. We each have our own sort of unique footprint of suffering. And if we start with being curious about it, we can even come to love it in a very intimate sort of way. Nenzen was talking yesterday in Zazen Kai about a friend who had told her to take that little traumatized girl and put it on her lap. In her practice. And it's like that. I don't think it's about trying to force anything, trying to force caring or love. But if you just witness, and if you witness deeply, you know, if I'm sitting here and I'm noticing some pain, and I let myself really taste it, then there's like an, I'm hurting. And love and compassion comes with that. I think that the thing for me that comes from that, from turning toward the suffering when we're on the cushion, that is the most beneficial on our Dharma path is that that magnet that I was talking about, that clinging and aversion, becomes less powerful. It doesn't have the same force to it. You know, when you see a teacher, like, you know, I always think of Kobun sitting. Boy, it was great to sit Sesshin with Kobun, because he was like the Buddha statue to me, you know. It's just so still, so at peace. And I imagined, you know, that what was going on inside him was this sort of like transcendent thing. And it took me decades to realize that's not what was going on inside him. What was going on inside him was exactly the same thing that's going on inside the rest of us. It's just that that magnet had just died down so much that he wasn't grasping or pushing away anymore. He was still in pain, you know. He was still having thoughts about his mistakes or other people's mistakes. It just didn't carry a lot of weight for him. And so that's, I think, why, you know, this teacher that I was talking about before used to say, "Have you heard the good news? We suffer because it is our suffering that gives us access to nirvana." The term nirvana actually means cooling cooling of passion. And I think one other thing that I've learned from this is that happiness, when it's not tied to a circumstance, becomes abundantly available. Abundantly available when that magnet starts to lose its power. What do you know? I'm just looking at my notes. See if there's anything else. Yeah, maybe just a little bit more. So, you know, what we talk about this the way in meditation, especially when we first start meditating, we're cultivating this capacity to let go of whatever we're holding on to in our meditation practice. And at first it's like letting go of a thought, right? But what I'm talking about is pretty much the same thing. But it's letting go of aversion, you know? It's where we're letting go of, I don't like that, in our bodies. And I think the only way there is to turn towards our suffering. Which sounds like bad news at first, and later on sounds like good news. I think I'd like to open it up for questions, both online and in the room. Yes.
Hello, should I raise your name?
Sure.
If you like. My name is Ty, and I study philosophy, so I really have a question. I'm interested. I was thinking about words during the meditation. I know I shouldn't be thinking. I wonder how much words and communication matter in your relation to your teacher and what you have spoken to us. It wouldn't transfer as what you wanted to, but how do you approach that? Mm.
Could you repeat that?
I will, yeah. I was just thinking that, because especially for people online, right?
So.
It does, yeah, thank you. Ty was saying that he has a background in philosophy and was curious about how language and words I think I could say sort of form our experience, something like that. Does that sound right? Yeah. Yeah, I think that is Jiro here? Did Jiro step out? Yeah. Hi, Jiro. I'm gonna call you out, Jiro. Do you mind?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I'll find a different example. Hmm. Ooh. That's a big one. We could go into that for a long time. I think that our entire notion of our own existence as individuals that are separate and yeah, that are separate comes from language. Juro probably knows now what I was going to say. There's a Pali word, I can't remember what it was, unfortunately, that is like categorizing mind. And we create, through language, we create this notion of self and other. And that's kind of where suffering begins, you know. And then if we reorient our language, then we can kind of reprogram ourselves in some ways, I think. Thank you for that question. Other questions? Yes.
I'm Joe. I
Hey,
think
Joe.
I might be missing the point by asking this question, but you mentioned when you were dealing with that founder-led board that you learned to turn towards your suffering. Did you find that in that situation it helped you better manage the situation or come to a conclusion that better suited you?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think the circumstances changed at all. I'm not sure that much of that was in my power to begin with, to be honest. I think that anybody in my position would have gone through the same thing that I went through. It was sort of like what was destined to happen. I did leave the job. That was good. Not necessarily because I had turned toward the suffering, but what it did do is that it made it much easier to be in it. Oh, yeah, no, please go ahead.
Which is not the same as desire, a want to obtain a certain level of excellence. For instance, you know, somebody wants to be excellent at ping pong, others want to be great at piano. I think that's not the same as desire. But you suffer. Because temporarily you're not there, your own level of excellence, or whatever that means. So, how do you think about the relationship between ambition and suffering? And how does that sort of
Yeah, I think that. Oh, I'm sorry. So, yeah.
Yes.
So she asked what the relationship is between suffering and ambition. That there can be suffering when you haven't sort of attained what you're striving for. Does that? Yeah, no, I think that when, you know, I'm using sort of this analogy of a magnet in the chest, and I think that it definitely is connected to that, right? Because that magnet in your chest is pulled towards that self that you strive to be, right? And where the suffering comes in is, like you said, in that gap between the self that you are now and the self that you strive to be. I think it's possible to have that ambition without expectation. So you're aware of the gap, but there's no suffering. You're not unhappy with the way things are now. I think that that actually the life of a Buddhist monastic is very much like that. There's a tremendous amount of resolve, you know, a great deal of effort. But it's also possible to hold the, you know, these high intentions and to not suffer, because you're not thinking that when you get to that place you'll be happy. That's a common trap. Problem is, you get there and it lasts for a moment, and then what? Then you're here. You're always here. Here is the only place we ever are. There's a body of vows that Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, Bodhisattva of Compassion took. I really love these vows. And one of the vows is to climb Nirvana Mountain. The vow to climb Nirvana Mountain. It's a very ambitious vow. And it takes diligent effort. Yeah, so I think, I don't think there's anything wrong with ambition. I think it can be a very good thing. It's just that question of whether or not you're happy with where you are now. Yeah, thank you. Does that answer your question? any follow-up questions? Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Hello. I'm Jay. I have a question. After surfing, after meditation, can you feel happy more than before? Easily?
Yes. Okay. So the question was, after meditation, can you feel happy more than before? Yes. Before you started meditation.
Yes.
Absolutely. I think it's also a trap to expect it. Very much like, you know, the last question. In fact, I think it's the expectation that causes the unhappiness. And funny enough, if you let go of the expectation, then happiness is so much more available. This came up last night in a conversation last night. Someone once told me that happiness is like, seeking happiness is like trying to catch a butterfly with your bare hands. Very difficult to do. Maybe possible, but very difficult. Whereas if you just stop trying, sit still, that butterfly might come and land on you. Thank you. Yes. Actually, yes, I may go with someone who hasn't asked a question. Is that? Yes.
My name is Sherry. I don't want to ask kind of a terrifying question.
Okay.
So you mentioned suffering versus a lot of the negative emotions, the quote-unquote negative emotions that you have, like anger and sadness. And you think those are experiences. Just, physical pain or anything like that.
Yeah.
What do you really mean by?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. So she asked, I had mentioned that we have these emotions and these states that you know, are often labeled as negative, like anger or sadness. And I was saying that that's not suffering. And the question was, if that's not suffering, then what is? What is suffering? I think that's a great question. And I think that, you know how I had talked about turning towards the suffering, particularly when you're on the cushion, but it's something you can do anywhere, anytime. And really exploring the experience of it. Because we turn away from it, we tend to have a pretty gross, generalized sense that it's this big, single thing, right? But when we really start to feel into it, we learn that it has many aspects. This is definitely connected to what in the Mahayana and Sanskrit we call the skandhas, the aggregates. They're like aspects of self, right? And we think of them as one big thing. That's why they're called the aggregates, because we think of them as one big thing. These sensations that we have, bodily sensations, feelings, thoughts, our physical form, our consciousness, our perceptions. We think of these as like all one thing, when in fact there are many different things. And so when we sit down on the cushion with this curiosity and we turn towards that suffering, we really feel into it, then we can start to see, oh, these two things are not the same thing. These are two different things. These feelings that I'm having are not the same thing as my aversion to them. They're two different things. So really, the suffering is the aversion. It's the not wanting it. That's where the suffering comes in. Or inversely, the wanting something, that's also suffering. Because either you don't have it, you want it and you don't have it, or you want it and you get it, and it's not what you had hoped for. Pretty much always, right? Thank you. Does that answer your question? No, there's... Yeah. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Okay, so she said, it sounds like turning to suffering has a lot to do with acceptance. Yes, so very much.
Trying to solve any problem, you just observe the problem itself and live in peace with it.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I think the Buddha really said that it's all an illusion, right? This is just all a dream. This is all an illusion. All this stuff we're trying to get, all of this stuff we're trying to fix, all of this stuff we're trying to get away from. Oh, and like Nenzen said yesterday, the Buddha also said, don't take my word for it. Figure it, like experience it for yourself. Experience it for yourself. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Misaki.
Misaki.
I have a question about the balance between my suffering and other suffering.
Mm.
For example, I am an only child, and I tried to study abroad to UC Santa Cruz, and I achieved this dream, but this decision made my family feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
They are feeling suffer because I left them.
Mm-hmm.
So, how can I say? When I chase my dream, to let to reduce my suffering. other people might to suffer due to my decision. So there is a big conflict in myself. So I want to know how you think about such a situation.
Yeah, thank you. And tell me your name again.
My name is Misaki.
Okay. Misaki said that that she had a question about the relationship between one's own suffering and the suffering of others. And she said that she has this dream to study abroad here in the United States, but coming to the United States to study abroad made her family sad because she was leaving. And so, you know, what's that relationship between making others sad in order to be happy? Yes? Yeah. Does that sound right? And you feel conflicted inside, yes?
Some guilt.
Yeah.
At the same time, I realize if I am not happy, I can't make others happy.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah, she said, at the same time, I realize that if I'm not happy, I can't make others happy. I think that all I need to do is let you keep talking and you'll answer the question for yourself. No, I think there might be sort of a larger, broader question there, though, right? And, you know, I think it's really a moment-by-moment kind of thing, you know, like this question. I don't even know what the question is. What's good? What's wholesome? And maybe the question changes too, right? And so we have to, you know, meet it fresh in every moment. But I think it's true. If you're not happy, then you can't. You know, put the mask on yourself first in the airplane, right? Put the mask on yourself first before you put it on someone else. And then this question, what is happiness? That's a really important question. What brings us happiness? Yeah, thank you. I think we have time for one more question. Yes. Yeah, you're talking, so the question was, when something really bad happens in your life, you know, how can we make peace with it? How can we accept that? That's a really important question. You know, you're talking about tragedy, I think. Yes? Yeah. It really feels like it's so important not to dismiss or diminish it, you know. When we have tragedy in our lives, one thing that we don't want to do is to pretend like it's not breaking us. We don't want to lie to ourselves. And it's not an easy path. But I feel like it is the same path. And in fact, for many of us on the Dharma path, it's really being with the tragedy in our lives. That gives us the capacity to be gracious, to have grace. And again, you know, that magnet. There's a difference between suffering and grief. I see those as two different things. It's possible to grieve without suffering. Grief can be beautiful because it's our love, right? Yeah. And there's no conversation that we can have here that can prepare us for tragedy. When tragedy comes, all we can do is meet it. And ultimately, it comes for everybody. We know how the story ends. As someone once told me, the big OQ. Thank you. I don't mean to make light of. Well, it is 11:30. That's the time, right? Am I right about that? Yeah? Okay. Thank you.
The bottom of page 2, after the Dharma talk.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.